is Ryan with Product Hunt Radio. I am at the Electric Objects pop-up studio in Lower East Side, New York. And I'm actually upstairs in some really janky attic with a bunch of beer. We're actually sitting on a bunch
janky.
Of beer. It's a little janky.
Perfect.
It smells a little funky, too.
Welcome to New York.
It's going to smell funkier because this is actually five dudes, actually. So five dudes in an attic. It's going to get a little hot.
Or weird.
maybe. But you guys want to introduce yourself? Who are these five dudes I'm hanging out with? Or four, rather.
I'll go first. I'm Nick Charles. I'm an early stage investor based here in New York, Brooklyn raised.
Nice.
I'm Will Pang. I'm an investor at a seed fund called Red Swan, also based here in New York.
I'm John Lax. I'm co-founder and partner at TNN Lax, design firm out of Toronto, Canada.
Jake Levine, founder of Electric Objects. We are making a computer for art, and we just launched on Kickstarter last Tuesday.
Sorry, I forgot to mention I'm also an advisor to Electric Objects.
Yeah, disclosure.
Oh, really? Very
Nick Charles.
Very important.
Value add advisor.
Hottest company in New York.
Do you have your own piece of art, animated GIF, like face?
Ooh.
I should.
If not, you should.
That's actually how Nick is being paid. He doesn't know that. But,
in animated
GIFs.
We're
just going to make him a GIF. Yeah. I think he thought he was going to get a piece of equity, but just a GIF. So I hope you're cool with that.
Totally.
Yeah.
So I actually caught your interview about a couple hours ago that was on TechCrunch to describe Electric Objects. But
yes.
And we actually talked about it on a previous podcast, I think the one I recorded yesterday. We chatted a little bit about it.
Mm-hmm.
What is Electric Objects, though, if you just want to go over it?
So, Electric Objects is it's a computer. We're building a new kind of computer. And it doesn't have a mouse, and it doesn't have a keyboard, and it lives on your wall. And the purpose of the computer is not for your interaction. It's not for productivity. It's not for entertainment. It's not really meant for you to use it. It's meant to display beautiful things from the internet, and so art, static images, animations, web-based visualizations. There's all this amazing stuff on the internet from, you know, what the Met Museum released a few months ago, 50,000 high-res scans into the public domain, to developers and artists creating these beautiful web-based visualizations powered by real-time wind data sets. And these things are just trapped inside of devices like our tablets, our laptops, our phones, devices that are designed for a different purpose, not a worse or better purpose, but designed for productivity and entertainment.
Yeah. I have a Game of Thrones character wearing throwback 80s gear.
No way.
On my Electric Objects.
I'm going to have to go grab that.
It's pretty incredible.
Do you guys remember screensavers, though? Of course you do.
Yeah,
but screensavers, we used to actually have them on our desktop computers all the time, and I would spend countless hours, maybe not countless hours, but a lot of time looking for cool screensavers on the internet. And
I still have one. I have the Giphy screensaver.
It's really cool.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that existed.
It does.
Yeah.
Does it just pull in random GIFs?
Yeah, it's like every 5 or 10 seconds or so, it'll throw up a new GIF.
Highly recommend
right.
that screensaver.
Very good.
Yeah.
Although there is like a very small percentage of porn. tiny, 0.1%.
Yeah.
And I have been in some very awkward situations where someone comes and is
right.
in my
surprise
computer.
And delight.
Yeah. So be careful.
Yeah.
Be careful.
Yeah. So
proceed with your own.
So Electric Objects is not for porn.
But could be.
That could be. I mean, nor is it for like things, you know, like a slideshow or it's not meant to feel like a screensaver that just shows up when you're not doing something else. It's the whole point of the thing is to give these objects from the internet, this artwork, persistence, which it currently doesn't have, because it's sort of, you know, when you find a piece of art online, you're sitting in front of your computer and you're competing, the piece of art is competing with emails and tweets and Facebook status updates and text messages and, the Word document that you have to finish and... If anyone still uses Word document, Product Hunt. Art just can't compete with Product Hunt.
I know,
and so we decided that it deserves its own kind of computer, and so we're trying to build a computer that you don't use.
Have you always been into art? Because this is, you've been, previously you were at Dig, right? Which, you know, I don't see much connection with art with Dig.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so I presented Electric Objects at the New York Tech Meetup a couple of weeks ago, and I used the exact same opener that I did for News.me, which became Dig, 2 years before, which was I opened with Who Here Loves the Internet, and then I said Who Here Feels Like the Internet is This Overwhelming Place. And so both projects were about taking this sort of anxiety around information overload and trying to present a solution for it. with news.me, we tried to do it with software. Electric Objects is doing it with hardware and saying, you know, it's not just that applications compete for our attention and make us feel overwhelmed by the amount of stuff happening on the internet. It's actually computers themselves that are designed for that sort of interaction.
I was lucky enough to sort of see a bit of the evolution of Electric Objects, and Jake, very early on, it sort of pitched the idea to me when you had, I mean, you just had that one screen in that office. It was like you alone. And my first reaction was, oh, okay, so like a digital picture frame, right? And but very quickly, I understood what was interesting was not that it was just a digital picture frame, but there was this whole software layer that existed that changed the dynamics of how you collected these electric objects or art, how you then displayed them, how you engaged with other people. And that's what made it just, because if it didn't have that, it is just an overgrown digital picture frame. Even though
it's meant to like take a moment and slow down and look at an image on your wall, it is still fundamentally networked, which is one of the most interesting pieces.
Yeah, totally. The first job of the hardware is to break your expectation with computers. Is to say that, like, you know, it hangs on your wall and it's in portrait and there's no keyboard or mouse. So, like, okay, step one, like, this isn't your everyday sort of monitor or TV. Step two is then to think about, okay, what does an art experience feel like on a network, on a connected device? So it starts with a community. And so John and Nick have been a part of a small group of testers who, and Ryan, have been a part of a small group of testers who have been using the product, and we basically just put it in their hands and said, put whatever you want on this thing. And so they would go around the web and collect images and animations and upload it to the network and then put it on their display. And you can see what other people are collecting, and you can see what other people are displaying. And then all of a sudden some artists showed up and started making work for the screen, and all of a sudden you've got this like really interesting work being produced for this new type of computer, and everyone's sort of experiencing it together. So it's about changing our relationship to computers, but it's also about experiencing art within a networked environment, which is, you know, what the internet is good at. It's connecting people.
The thing that I find interesting is that all of these social networks, I guess in this broadly bucketed recent generation of social networks, have been focused on how can you maximize some key metric of like number of likes or number of favorites or number of reposts, and I think
vanity metrics.
Yeah. Initially, it was really cool to see you post something and have it just spread like wildfire. That's a really cool phenomenon, but maybe it's a backlash now where I honestly don't care as much about the pure number of people who have also seen it or also shared it, but rather I think it's like what you've built is a very real life experience. Like imagine if everybody saw the same thing, or if I could put, if you let me choose what I wanted to put on your wall.
I think pushing art or pushing content to friends would be fascinating. I don't know, I'm sure you thought a million years ahead of us in terms of what that could look like in the future, but I would love to be able to, just like Snapchat, sort of push content to my friend's wall. Of course, I have some friends back at home.
What was early an example of that that kind of blew my mind the first time I saw it was the little printer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah, of course.
Berg. Remember that?
I don't.
Printer?
No,
it's made by a company called Berg. Yeah. I think it's a design studio in London.
They have a little printer, they have Berg Cloud as well now.
Right. It's basically a tiny little device. It's like
it's a thermal printer, like a receipt printer.
It literally prints receipts, except what you can do is you can basically send someone messages.
Oh,
so like they might wake up in the morning and they'll receive like a, hey Nick, hope you have a great day. And it was like, it was the first moment where I saw this this interaction basically occur, and the output was something in the real world, right? Like a receipt or something on your wall, and it was kind of mind blowing.
I think the internet, the wave of the Internet of Things companies has been focused on productivity and focused on efficiency, right? And like or like analytics. But the home is this place where you're supposed to that's supposed to reflect your personality, and it's a place where you're supposed to feel comfortable. And so it's kind of weird that we haven't really spent much time trying to find ways to make the home more beautiful or to make the home a more sort of pleasant place to live. And so the Electric Objects could be considered an Internet of Things product that's focused on providing pleasure, not just sort of utility and analytics. To your point, Will about sort of metrics and like the, you know, like likes and reblogs and reposts. And I think, you know, the one of the things that that many sort of internet applications, like software applications, have to do is their sort of their performance is measured on the basis of how many people are using the thing every day. And so their goal is to maximize daily active use, sessions per day, time per session, which means mm-hmm. that they, alongside the thousands of other people building applications, are competing for your attention. And so what you end up with is everyone wants to send you push notifications, everyone wants to send you emails, everyone wants you to maximize your interaction within their system, and you end up with a feeling of being overwhelmed. Right. And so the weird thing about this product is that, like, there's no... people might not use it for 6 months. Like, you might not change the animation on your wall for 6 months, but is that a bad... Like, at first, I was like, oh, man,
well,
no one's using
it. There's one way to do
right.
it, where if it's on 24 hours a day, every
right.
single user
right.
is
it's
a user
daily
24
active
hours a day. Right,
permanent.
Right.
Yeah. So you're going to put ads is what you're going to do. You're gonna
yeah.
ads right in the
my
middle.
Point
monthly
is,
active
yeah,
users,
100%.
Yeah, I literally use it 100% of the time.
Session time is
right.
infinity. Yeah.
Yeah, it would be like Pepsi gifts. Just be,
it's a weird yeah. product, and like, and so it's a weird thing to explain to investors and users. But once you sit with it, it I think it makes sense.
Can you just loop back on that? You said something that I thought was interesting, which is, you know, the Internet of Things, and at least the products that have kind of exploded have either been, you know, fitness was this first, you know, surge. Then I see a lot of IoT location-based stuff, which just seems to be optimized around delivering a coupon to you. Mm. And you're saying, well, no one's really doing anything for the home. And so it would arguably, like, Nest, like, home control
yeah,
was, were some of those things. But you're talking about, like, almost a decorative item. And, you know, as you said that, I was like, oh, that's right. And I was trying to think, well, why have more product people not kind of attack that problem? And is it that it's just not an it doesn't seem like an interesting problem? Is it that... you kind of the people who should be solving it are kind of like the Martha Stewarts of the world, but we're not really going to expect them to solve that problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think generally more people are going to be rallying around things that appear to be broken, right? Or, you know, or like or I don't know. I mean, I don't have a really good
no,
answer.
It's kind
of
interesting, right? Because like I guess what you're saying is like people are attacking the kitchen. And like and when you look at the home, the kitchen and the bathroom,
right.
and
things
you know,
that
provide the temperature, right? Utility. And what you're actually, for the most part, looking at is the living room or the
bedroom.
And so, like, I don't know.
Well, it's almost like the bias. I think, especially of product people, and maybe this is like men too. Is like, how do we solve objective problems that
right.
have data that I can, you know, I can control my environment, right? And the thing that you're really dealing with is, yeah, there's that aspect of it, but it's far more subjective, right? It has
yeah.
to do with, you're using words like mood, and I think that there's not a lot of, maybe because they're difficult problems to solve, or they don't seem...
Well, many consumer apps are driven by emotional needs, which are really
right.
hard to validate until you build something. And
so I don't have an explanation for why that's the case, why
right.
a lot of the connected devices seem to focus on utilitarian focused products, but I do think that there is an opportunity, actually, for a lot of the physical products and the connected devices that come out to actually focus a little more on the emotional.
Yeah.
I think when you focus too much on utility-based products, and you focus only on that, like focus on what the product does, you look at all these new connected watches that come out, they all look
mm-hmm.
the same. I have no emotional connection with the watch. I'm still going to wear my analog watch because I love it.
Yeah.
And there's another analogy that I wanted to bring in from a designer named Frank Camaro. And he talked about redesigning his personal website in the context of what is a digital homestead. And he talked about how when you walked into an architect's home, that is actually the ultimate representation of that architect's personality because they can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And I think there are very few digital products that actually do this really well. One of them I think that does it real well is Instagram, actually, where the product itself, the app itself, is actually, it fades into the background. And if you look at each person's sort of grid of everything that's above the fold and below the fold, it's actually a great at-a-glance representation of that person's personality.
Yeah.
That's that person's digital homestead.
Yeah.
So I wonder whether that sort of similar idea can be translated to the real world. So all these connected devices, yes, we're going to upgrade our analog devices to become digital devices, or digital devices actually produce analog results like the little printer. But I think this next generation of connected devices are going to be really exciting because I think designers are going to start to understand, okay, utility is somewhat of a commodity. How can you combine utility and emotion to have actually an interesting product?
And generally, I think, like, you know, the first people that attack a space tend to be interested in technology and seeing what technology can do. There's this amazing quote from this guy Mark Weiser in the early 90s, who worked at Xerox PARC and talked a lot about comp computing. And like, this guy was like light years ahead of where we are today, and this was like 15 years ago. And he was saying, you know, technology computers, like, we need to start building computers that, I'm going to butcher this quote, but we need to start building computers that fit the human environment as opposed to forcing humans to enter theirs. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like we've, you know, because of the last 15 years, we've forgotten that computers can be something else. We've forgotten that computers can be more than just about analytics and productivity and entertainment. And this guy writing in the 90s had the perspective, because computers were new and the internet was barely, you know, in existence, that they can be so much more. And so I think, you know, in the first wave of a new sort of category of technology, you have people building the technology itself, like the infrastructure, right? And then I think what Electric Objects benefits from is, you know, a Raspberry Pi community,
yeah,
which absolutely makes it easy for somebody who doesn't, like myself, who doesn't know much about technology, mm-hmm, to like build a prototype.
Right. Well, it's hilarious when we were emailing and you're like, you want to try the prototype? Here's a link, and it was a package of some cables, Raspberry Pi. I had an old monitor that I wasn't using.
Yeah.
And you had instructions, and I just like pieced it together and
totally
it worked.
I mean, the reason why I could build this company is because of the last 5 years of people investing in, you know, connected devices.
Yeah.
And the fact that, like, Pis are $35 and I can buy a monitor for $150 on Amazon and I can hack together,
yeah,
this prototype, which gets the point across.
Do you guys see parallels between the software, this revolution and sort of Mark Andreessen saying software is eating the world, and the hardware space, the connected devices space? I know that we're maybe in an inflection point. I think maybe a year ago was still, like, hardware and connected devices are a gimmick. But do you guys think that it's sort of here to stay, and things like Raspberry Pi are going to sort of form the foundational layer that a lot of the sort of like GitHub or Django or jQuery, of any of these things that have helped enable the explosion of software products and innovations?
I think to John's point earlier, you know, at least Electric Objects, and I actually think most of the interesting connected devices are basically software products, and they're only hardware to the extent necessary. You know,
yep.
I think the companies that are going to build a watch that you're willing to wear are going to be fashion companies, and they'll build in technology when the technology's, you know, ready for them, right?
Yep.
And right now you have a bunch of geeks working on watches, and
Google
they're
going
to but once that is commodified, you can start to build it into fashion. You see it with like Ringley, like Christina Mercado's thing. Where she's building a jewelry brand, but it just happens to have a computer inside of it.
There's a gap, though, that we're missing right now. So if you kind of think on a spectrum, right, on one end you got like Samsung and LG, like the massive consumer electronics manufacturers who are able to engineer, produce, you know, create electronics, and, you know, out the door. And now we've had on the other side of the spectrum this kind of maker community, you know, powered by Android. And in the middle, there's sort of this big gap, right?
Yeah.
So I think the real challenge for the IoT is that you can kind of make prototypes really easily, which is amazing. You can manufacture more cheaply, but it's like easy to make one of something, pretty easy to make 10 of something, and then after that, it just goes off a cliff where you start to get into manufacturing, and that is not well formed right now.
Yeah, I think it will be, though. And there's definitely a bunch of folks that are spending all of their hours thinking about it, whether it's, you know, Dragon,
PCH,
innovation, and PCH. And so I would, if I was a betting person, which I am, I would bet that becomes more developed in the next
couple. It will, but I think that right now there's a bit of a utopian view, like it's like really easy to cross that chasm, because you spin up your first, you know, you go to SparkFun, you buy a bunch of parts, and, you know, you through your own will and ingenuity, you kind of get this prototype and be like, oh my god, it works, right? And the screen lights up and you're able to push an image to it or things like that. And you are like, you know, a half an inch on a marathon that you're about to embark on. And I think that sometimes gets misunderstood.
Yeah.
And you're right, there are people working on that problem. And the question is how long will it take? But I think the big movement that we've really gotten is, I mean, you know, we've been playing around with hardware for the last 3 years in various forms, And I mean, just the ability for us to go online, order things from whether it's SparkFun or another supplier, have them show up the next day, and be able to get that thing working. You're like, oh my God, that it works. Yeah, it is possible.
Yep.
Yeah.
That didn't exist five
years
ago.
Imagine going from there to like potential company out of the box, essentially, which, you know, maybe there's some benefits and negatives to that, but that's like a pretty amazing world in the same way that you can build a web app now at scale.
Right.
You know, essentially.
We're like at basic. Like we're at the equivalent in software of like being able to write, you know, go to line, like we're there, right?
Yep.
But we're not at the point where we're like able to there's a big gap between that and Heroku. You
there's,
know,
there's like, the, right, yeah, there's nothing. There's like nothing near Heroku. I mean, when
Heroku for hardware.
Yeah,
it took
AWS
me,
for. I mean, there's a lot of people that are.
It took me 2 weeks to like build the product that, you know, John, Nick, and Ryan have in their homes, and that validated that like this is something interesting. It took me like 9 months to get it to a place where I knew I could produce it at a cost that made sense to users. I had to hire somebody with 15 years of consumer electronics experience. And it's not just, you know, I met like a bunch of engineers, mechanical engineers, industrial designers, people who were very good, but who, if they've never been through the production process, it's like a completely different skill set. And it's very much relationship based. And those things, relationships are hard to scale. And so you do have services firms popping up like Dragon Innovation, PCH has launched their accelerator, but it's very expensive. It's very expensive to use them, and it's very expensive to, you know, PCH will, you know, they have an accelerator, so they'll want to own part of your company.
Isn't part of that accelerator spending 2 weeks in China?
Yeah.
Like, that's part of the program?
They will take you. PCH has this program called Highway One. It's actually, I mean, it's not, you know, I say it's expensive, but it's, you know, infinitely cheaper than, it, you know, the same sort of learning process was, you know, 2 years ago, and we're, you know, we're talking to Dragon Innovation and may work with those guys, but Highway One is this program where you you go out for, I think it's 3 months. Brady Forrest is running it, and Christina did it from Ringley, who I just mentioned. Sarah Chips is doing it. Cool. And
I don't know if I had, that may have been out of, I don't know if that's
email me out
like
it.
I don't know.
And so you go and you spend 3 months, and they have a team of engineers from PCH that work with you. PCH is a massive, I think it's like a supply chain operations company. I think that's how you describe
it. There, yeah.
And they like, I think they manage Apple's supply chain.
They do.
So like, for, you know, it's really interesting that they're taking a bet on tiny little companies. They're basically betting that these companies are going to be big enough one day to be their customers.
Right.
And in the process, they'll take a piece of equity. So it's a super interesting model. And so you'll see more PCHs, you'll see more Dragon Innovations, and I think that's going to do wonders. But we are still like pretty far away from Heroku. We're also pretty far away from just...
What does pretty far away for you mean, though?
Five years.
Okay.
5 years. We're also kind of far away from... just actually, and this is more important, but like, so the guy I hired to
in the grand scheme of things,
like 5 years isn't that long.
No, it's not that long. It's not that long. In startup world, it feels like an eternity.
Right.
But the guy I hired to lead the hardware for my company is this guy named Bill. He's a co-founder, and he's 15 years of experience managing production processes, mechanical engineer, industrial design. He's like perfect for what we need, but. It's like we don't even know that these people exist in startup land, in New York startup culture, in my guess is in Silicon Valley as well.
Yeah.
You've got like people are surprised when I tell them that there are 1,000 engineers, 1,000 people working at a company called Crestron in New Jersey that they've never heard of. And it's a high-end audio-video tech company that has been in operation for 50 years. It's $1 billion in revenue. And all they do is build consumer electronics products and take it to production.
Yeah.
And they're like across the river. And we're struggling to find the people to work at these startups in New York.
I got a funny Crestron story. I actually have a very funny. So, Crestron, if you've ever been in a boardroom, there's an inevitable moment at the beginning where someone tries to go to the Crestron panel and figure out like how to bring the screen down, how to draw the blinds, and it's like eventually like an IT guy is called, right? And it's sort of like, if you've ever been in enough business meetings, you've experienced that sort of thing. So I get called out to Crestron for a meeting a few years ago. And I walk in, and they've got the boardroom with the panel and everything like that. The meeting starts. They're like trying to figure out how to work their own system. And they're like, we got to call someone in. And I was like, well, it happens to you guys too.
Right.
But actually, it was on the other side, they walked me around the facility there at Crestron. And what was interesting at the time was they are so obsessive about engineering that, you know, if anyone has ever done any HDMI working with HDMI, it's a really troublesome protocol to work with. Plugging in a DVD player from Sony into a DVD TV, both using HDMI, there's no guarantee that they're going to communicate because they have these handshaking errors. And what Crestron do is they literally buy one piece of equipment from every manufacturer, and they have a database where they autocorrect all the handshaking. It is tedious,
it's
painful.
It's like a QA nightmare.
They take it on, and like that's the hardware world, right? It's like it's sort of like vague standards, and it's you overcome it with sort of heavy engineering chops. And I think that on the software side, especially in the last 10 years, you know, these ideas that you know people can start up, you know, learn programming over a weekend and have launch an app and fund it, you know, get it funded.
Yeah.
That isn't, and I would say 5 years is optimistic that on the hardware world that we're gonna, you know, that we're gonna get there. There's a lot of built up legacy in the hardware world, the DigiKey world, like learning how to do parts ordering, like basic electrical engineering.
Yeah.
That I'm not sure how quickly we're going to be able to overcome that with kind of procedural systems that will just automate it all.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
This is the curmudgeon in me, which is like, is there a point where it being too easy to build something out of the box is actually a problem?
No.
A bad thing.
No.
It's actually a bad thing.
Whenever you lower the barriers to creativity, it's like a net positive for the world. That's my answer.
That's a good answer. I mean, on the other hand, right?
Like was it bad when cameras got cheaper and more people could take
photos? No, I mean, I guess the point is that like there's a certain amount of what I like to see in like founders and companies that fund is a certain amount of like struggle. Like,
well, so there's more
right pushing through like difficult. No, but for real, right? Like, and I've done that too.
Yeah,
right through companies.
No,
that
there's
I've,
more.
That I've
you have a harder job. Investors have a harder job because you have to sift through more noise in software because it's so easy to start a company. That investors are now looking at like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of companies a month. I mean, the number of companies that come through Product Hunt, I'm sure all of them are wonderful, but the number of companies that get posted on Product Hunt every week, there's like, and they're all sort of, they all look like startups, and they're all trying to raise money, and they all kind of, you know, there's you can sort of get as niche as you want, but there are 15 people working on it. It's a problem for investors. I also think, honestly, it's a problem for the industry, because it's just like, it stops being inspiring. It stops being like a place where you want to go hang out.
But you just said that bar none.
I know.
It is good to lower. The
I know. I'm sympathizing with
gonna,
you.
Yeah, there's
I'm sympathizing with you as an invest. I'm sympathizing with the investors in the room. Saying I realize your job is harder. I'm sorry about that, but like my job's pretty hard too.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
So you posted a really weird product. Not a weird product, but a very unique product.
It's a robot.
It's open for some build up there.
I know.
You guys have ever seen the movie Oblivion and those drones that fly around?
Yeah.
This is basically one step closer to that.
Is that the one with Matt Damon?
No, it's Tom Cruise.
Okay, so for those of us who haven't seen Oblivion, can you back up?
So
there's drones that fly around.
There's drones
that
fly around.
And Tom Cruise.
And Tom Cruise.
So Tom Cruise is like this guy who's working for this entity, who knows what it is, no spoilers here, but he starts to regain a sense of free will.
That's right.
And so this drone basically has this scanner that scans him up and down and scans things up and down and decides whether it's a threat. It has these four massive guns attached to the side that pop out. And it's scary as hell if you're like facing this thing head on.
Yeah.
And this is a product called Nightscope, and it's basically that except it doesn't fly, and it doesn't have any guns in it yet.
So all the cool stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, so wait, what does it do?
So it's basically this robot is about the size of a human being. It's white.
It is white. It reminds me of Portal. Remember, did you play Portal?
Yeah,
it's got that white kind of medical kind of Portal vibe.
And it has all these sensors in it. And it basically does imaging on its surroundings and X-ray and infrared. And it basically can map out its surroundings in 3D. And the goal of it is to actually help police predict and prevent crime.
Yeah. Oh my it's God. Sort of like replacing, from my understanding, replacing
We're there.
Control.
We're there.
Wait, yeah. Does it look like a human?
Okay, I was imagining. Well, have you ever seen, Asimo, the Honda robot?
That's yeah,
pretty it is the creepiest. Yeah. It looks like it's. I've seen it do like demos where it dances and things like that, and it looks like it's going to just jump out of the crowd and just kill everyone.
Seen the crazy robots that are running and galloping. Yeah. They look very kind of uncanny and unnatural.
So, didn't Google just buy that? Yeah. Boston Dynamics or whatever.
Oh wow,
they've got like that. I think it's called Boston Dynamics. Like that creepy sci-fi dystopian universe.
Can I ride one? Down
creepier
to, like,
or less creepy than the robot in Rocky 4.
Oh, Rocky the one that he put the one that he punches.
Yeah.
Or the maid is the butler.
Yeah. But I mean, I think it's fascinating because there are two reasons. One is that it is a hardware product that is also a software product, like we were mentioning before, because it's doing all this big data analysis on and basically trying to predict when a crime is going
to
happen.
So wait, are they selling it to police forces?
Yes.
It's like a government, so they sell to government?
So they're actually helping the police do a better job. And which you think about is actually from the outside.
It's trying to predict a crime, like pre-crime?
Now we've gone into Minority Report.
This is basically a review of movies.
That's phase two.
I saw a movie last night that I'd like to talk about. Can you actually describe? So it scans the environment, and then what does it do with that information?
It basically creates these 3D models, heat maps of for example, if somebody's moving in a threatening way or somebody's in trouble, you can know immediately when that's happening.
I can already hear the protesters.
Yeah.
Hey, I watched RoboCop 2 or 3 weeks ago, the new one.
Is it a new one?
Yeah, there's a new one. God. Yeah. And it has a whole world where, you know, there are robots, cops all over the place.
And the robots are all racist.
Are they? I fell asleep, I stopped watching.
Yeah.
All right.
But
it sounds interesting. I don't know. I feel like I need to learn more about it before I decide if
you don't
want to
buy
morally
one
yet, objectionable.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
But actually, speaking of safety, though, have you guys heard of SafeTrack?
No.
SafeTrack is cool. It's like this app that you open up, and if you're feeling like you're unsafe, let's say you're walking home at night.
Oh, I've heard of this.
Mm. Yeah, you open up the app, and you put your finger on the screen,
yep.
And as long as your finger's on it,
wow.
It's fine. But when you let go, you have 10 seconds to enter in a PIN, and that's how you signal the cops. It calls.
And that's brilliant. It's like those the lights on the college campuses.
Yep.
Yeah, cool. But now it's in your pocket.
Right.
That's really clever.
Right.
Yeah.
Love that.
Pretty cool idea.
Love that.
And I could see the use case. What's it called again? The robot?
Nightscope,
which is also a very interesting name choice.
What
Nightscope,
if the robots use that app?
I would use that app around the robots.
True. But college campuses is a good use case for that.
Yeah,
college campuses are good.
That's a nice that's a nice
Brooklyn
product.
Once upon a time.
Yeah.
It's a very elegant solution.
Yeah. Yeah.
And who comes to save you?
911.
It calls 911.
Yeah. What were you telling us about earlier? An ugly app that you love?
Oh, this is probably
this is like
not,
a guilty pleasure.
Yeah,
this
is
like
probably
this
not
is
worth mentioning. But there's this app called Chess Time. It is God. I hope the creators of the app never listen to this podcast. It is probably the ugliest chess app that's ever been created. But,
so why do you
but
like
highly
it?
Functional?
Yeah.
And I'm obsessed with chess, so I play it all day. Basically, I've got like 4 or 5.
Did you
games
learn
going
to
at any
play
time.
Chess with it, or you've known how?
No,
to
I played chess for a long time and love chess. And
do you play against other people?
Yeah.
Or okay.
Friends, other bizarre people that somehow found Chess Time and play it, even though it's the worst designed chess app.
Is it like Words with Friends, where it's
and there's ads all over it? Basically, for those
so
I can don't download the app unless you want to play me at chess.
Yeah,
and
what's your username?
And my handle is Ntrolls.
And
if you want to play,
I guarantee you that the authors are not listening to this because they're probably somewhere in the Ukraine or Estonia.
Yes.
And
they're milking every penny too.
Yeah.
Those.
In other words, it's an app that lets you play chess with Nick. Wait, but can you? But let me ask you a question, Nick.
I won't challenge anybody.
If it were more beautiful, let's say that like Tien and Lax got their hands on it and redesigned it, and it's like this gorgeous and like really aesthetically pleasing. Would it be? Let's say it was more aesthetically pleasing. Would it be
better or worse?
Better or worse?
Like, do you like it?
It's a really good question. I mean, this is like a
you bought
social
it,
engineering
yeah.
question.
Sort of like Craigslist, right?
And I've got a rating.
Yeah.
You've got what?
You've got a rating. Oh, you're invested.
And then lock in.
I've built up a pretty good.
It's juice. Pretty big reputation.
I guess what I'm asking is like, it,
I have some reputational capital on Chess Time.
Does the fact that the design?
I'm a god on Chess Time. Is it all the 10 users?
Is it? I mean, is it just happenstance that you ended up developing a network in this?
I was invited by a friend.
Okay, and do you think that
I was invited by a random friend that plays chess, and I never would have installed the app unless it was a chess app, and I installed it, and the rest is love affair with chess.
And how important to your experience is the network and the people and like the gameplay that comes out of the network?
It's pretty important. Like I have, it's a lot of random people, but
I now have
Chess Time meetups. Yes. You know, I have a rating, and there's 4 or 5 friends that I play on it, and so, you know, the reality is that migrating people from this really poorly designed app to a really nicely designed app is probably something I don't want to do.
But also, I mean, and so the reason I'm asking is because I wonder if like
functionality.
I wonder if the fact that like you have to really want to play chess to download this app and to engage with it, right? And so what your network is then a subset of people. It's not the chess with friends or whatever the Zynga population is. It's the population that really just want to play chess and like only care. It's just really, really, really want to play chess enough to put up with a shitty experience.
Yeah.
Or a shitty design at least. And which makes it an amazing experience in some ways.
True.
Software lesson.
So
lesson
John,
is.
Yeah, so
I'm not.
Stay away from chess.
I'm gonna stay away from it.
This is the winner right here. Yeah. Winner in the category.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some sites and applications that, by all objective measure, are just not well designed, but yet are very, very successful in accomplishing what they do. And people kind of whether they just overlook it. It's not that big a deal. You know,
or it's by design.
Sorry?
You know, it could be by design to an extent.
Rarely do I think it's actually by design. I think it's generally because whoever created it just was working with what they were working with, and this kind of did what it needed to do, and then it wasn't broke, so they never fixed it. You know, I mean, Craigslist is kind of the Uber example of that, right? Which is, by every objective measure, it's just not... It doesn't look good. It hasn't been redesigned in ever, and yet it still continues to do what it does very, very well. And it would sort of seem silly to try to, like, a redesign would make it worse, right? At this point.
Yeah.
Although Craigslist is, to a certain extent, slowly starting to get picked apart.
Maybe. Oh, you mean from competitors?
Yeah. From people that are, you know, picking off pieces of Craigslist here and there.
Right. Well, actually, I saw something really interesting.
Do you think Craigslist will exist 10 to 15 years from now?
I do, and I think that it has kind of at this point, just at even in slow erosion, it would take 10 or 15 years for it to do it. But I saw two products that kind of come to mind when I think about that. One is Reverb.com, which is someone had this thought about musical instruments, purchasing musical instruments through eBay is kind of a difficult, crappy experience. So they created a classified site just for musical instruments, mainly guitars, amps, that kind of thing, right? Because there's a lot of inventory, and it's really beautifully designed product. I don't know whether it's more successful, but there's someone sort of challenging a layer of eBay specifically, and there are people challenging sort of small parts of
Craigslist.
Some other parts of Craigslist or any kind of classified system. The other one was the guys who created Domainr. Have you ever played with Domainr?
Yeah.
I was at...
What's Domainr?
Domainr's a domain name finding service, but it's just really super easy. And
what was the one I saw you tweeting about one?
A domain finding one? I don't remember.
Where you purchased the domain?
Oh, that was just on GoDaddy. But I was using
Honeybit. Check out GoDaddy. It's really good.
GoDaddy's
right. Discount.
Yes.
That's what it was.
Yeah. Quick side note. Yeah. Honey is a great Chrome extension. You go to sites like GoDaddy, you click a button, and it searches for a bunch of coupons and tries them all. Hmm. And I got a domain for like $4 the other day.
Yeah. As opposed to the $8.99 it
was. Yeah, I know. But it takes 30 seconds.
But the thing about
Scrappy Founder,
the guy, I'm blanking on the name of the guy who created Domainr, so I apologize. But
so Connor, by the way, Connor's a friend of mine. He was on the show, and he helped work on Domainr.
Okay, so what he told me was, he says, if you can find something on the web that's sort of a crappy experience and just put a layer over it that's better, there's a business to be made there. And they do actually make a kind of pseudo living on Domainr through the referral fees they do, just by kind of, because domain searching is a kind of janky on network solutions and GoDaddy, and that's all they just did was they put a veneer over it, better designed veneer over one aspect, and then they shuttle it. And he's like, they make I don't want to blow up their spot, but like they do well enough that it allows them to do anything, and it kind of runs itself. So I think I can see both sides of the argument on, like, you know, good design versus bad design. That I think if you can just improve certain parts or start to strip away at things, and at, you know, what we're seeing right now with all of these monolithic entities like Craigslist or Facebook is this unbundling, right? This effort of saying having one design solution that rules everything is probably not, you know, feasible over time, because if we don't unbundle, people will start attacking the parts and slowly, stripping us away. And I think it remains to be seen, you know, whether this unbundling that's going on will be successful or how it'll play out, or will it just create this massive fragmentation that can never be tied together, you know, in any meaningful way at scale that these businesses will need. I think that's an open question.
Have
right
we
now.
Reached peak unbundling with the launch of Yo? Can you get any less, any more unbundled than that?
Like you're down to the atomic unit of communication. Like, is it grunt?
Well, okay. The question is
just like grunting.
How do you unbundle the question?
Can you? I mean, another app that I wanted to talk about is this one called Lock, which is supposed to be a product hunt.
Fascinating.
I thought it was interesting because, number one, innovation happens on Android first before iOS in this case. But what it is that it's a lock screen messaging app, and you create these groups of people you trust. And you can basically quickly message them. And so other people who have this as their lock screen app, they open it up, it's the first thing they see.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting because the app is not really an app anymore. It's kind of a push notification. It's I think the push and the app are sort of being unbundled.
Yeah.
I think the what you actually do is being unbundled from the app or the device that you use, like with the new iOS 8 and the new OS 10 updates that are coming out in the fall. This whole idea of like continuity.
Yeah.
So I just think it's interesting where, who knows whether Lock is going to be successful.
What's interesting about Lock is it doesn't, and I haven't used it, so I'm just judging it based on what I've seen, is that it doesn't require you to respond. Like a text message, you expect a response.
Right.
It's a sort of a way of communicating and engaging with each other, but it's sort of ambient. It's not something that you have to like actually engage with yourself. And so when you're pulling out your phone, you might see a message, you might see a photo or some doodle or something from a friend, and you're not obligated to do anything with that. But now you've interacted somehow.
Yeah. Going back to Nick's point, though, earlier about, like, is there a diabolical side to sort of allowing anyone to create one thing? And I think that, you know, one of the things that
keeps creeping back. Well,
Product Hunt, you know, the one thing I'm struck is I go there every day and I see this whole new group, and there's these people who are creating these very micro, you know, products that do like one thing very specifically, and they created it in a very short period of time. And the idea that as human beings, we could possibly manage 40 or 50 or 100 small things to do, the one precise, I want to send a yo, I have this, you know, use case, I'm going to do that. And that we will ebb and flow between wanting monolithic applications that kind of have it all bundled in one place to aggregating a lot of small, very precise products that do, you know, very, very, you know, singular, sort of single-use things. And I think that one thing that the Product Hunt community probably biases to is because these people are early adopters, you're willing to, like, download that thing, try it for a little while, then when the next thing comes in, you know, you're pretty promiscuous about trying these things. But the real challenge is how many of them stick around and how many of them will really take root, and just statistically speaking, there's no way most of the things that we see on Product Hunt just will not be around in a meaningful way, a year or two from now.
And so it's so difficult to tell, right? Sometimes between the things that are, you know, truly emotionally meaningful and will last many years versus, you know, things that are in fact game, like mostly like a game, right? I mean,
the fads and trends are indistinguishable.
Right?
They
look
in the early
like
days.
Popular games.
I think you know, generally it's so Mark Andreessen wrote that some tweet storm or like a blog post about unbundling, and it's easy to mistake like a sort of a concept like that for just people working on small problems, right?
Yeah.
It's like there's unbundling, which is sort of a generational thing that has to do with like new platforms emerging or like significant sort of secular changes in in user behavior, or things like Facebook making it possible to port your address book, or mobile phone making it sort of more likely that, you know, apps will start to do like start to narrow a little bit, just purely on the basis of like the way that Apple designed their operating system. With it's easy to confuse those sort of like major trends with like an app that just does one thing because like the creator just was interested in doing that one thing.
Right. Well, I think there's a natural tendency in the startup community, right, to equate someone that's interested in exploring an idea or an app or a product,
yeah,
and turning that into something that has to be a company,
right,
that has to be funded by big dollars, that has to be venture driven, right? I mean, there's a lot of people that are making stuff on the internet and with the intention of not necessarily having it be a big venture-backed company.
Yeah, and the sort of sad thing, and Nick and I have talked a lot about this, the sad thing is that, you know, it's like there's a, if you have something that works, whether or not it ought to be a company, you know, there's a pressure to sort of force it into this category, this box. Into which you can pour venture capital dollars.
Well, it's sexy right now to raise money and to build a company.
And it's kind of easier than it ever was in the past.
And it's what the people around you, like, that's quote-unquote success, right?
Right?
Oh, we raised a round, and, like, that's become the equivalent of, you know...
You made it.
Some level have made it.
And so you have these things that should exist as they are, that should have one or two developers working on it, and maybe they're generating enough cash to pay for their salaries or part of their salaries, and you have these things, and then they feel like there's this momentum towards venture capital. But I think what people don't realize is as soon as you raise venture capital, you are closing yourself off to a bunch of different opportunities and a bunch of different ways to take that product. And so, you know, this is a lesson that like many people I think learn the hard way and realize only like a year and a half after they've raised money that, oh wow, I actually like. Now I need to go, like, you know, into large media agencies and sell ads because I have all these people working here and I, like, oops. And so I think there's, I don't really know my point other than just an observation and a hope that, like, there's a category of funding emerging that can support businesses that don't need to be, that don't need to grow 10 or 20x.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're on
or
Kickstarter.
Not, right?
And
there's a category of people that continue want to create creative things on the internet
and
elsewhere, and they do that for that.
Yeah, I mean, I sit through, I meet a lot of entrepreneurs who, I ask them, why are you raising capital?
Yeah.
And probably 75% of the time they go into what, they want to hire two engineers, they want to hire a designer. I'm like, that's not why you raise. That's what you're going to do with the money. And maybe 20% of the people say, oh, so we can move faster. And I'm just like, where are you moving faster to? And so few entrepreneurs, there's maybe the top 1-5% of entrepreneurs who actually know where they're going. They know that venture capital is going to help them get there, but venture capital is not a means to an end. Venture capital is a means to an end rather than the end itself.
Right? Do you see that? Is that an age thing? Like, so you've got someone who's in their early 20s who's or versus someone who's maybe a bit more mature who has a different answer to that question?
I think there is a correlation. I don't know. There might be a little causation in there in that somebody older might have tried a bunch of things and sort of got it out of their system. But I've seen older entrepreneurs also fall prey to the community, feeling validated because we're all doing things that are fundamentally, by definition, radical. And the thing about radical things is that they don't look like something that's widely accepted early on. They look weird, by definition. And so we are all looking for external validation in some way, and sort of having somebody invested $1 million is one of the greatest validations in the short term. And something that I want to say miss, maybe I don't see it happening but as much, but just the like maybe 5 years ago in New York, there was this group of sort of 10, 20 people who just love building creative projects. Those people still exist. Some of them are working in a few companies. Some of them are still working on their own things. But like, what happened to building something just because you without any sort of reason for building it other than you wanted to?
There's a company in New York called Shutterstock. No one talks about it. It's a bootstrap company that IPO'd a couple weeks ago, worth multiple billions of dollars. And I'm convinced that one of the main reasons that no one talks about it, no one cares about it, is because they didn't raise a massive amount of venture capital money.
And stock photography.
Greylock or anything. I mean, it's not that sexy. It's not a super sexy business, but yeah. It's like probably the most successful startup.
It employs hundreds of people.
You know, technology company in New York in the last 5 to 7 years. I mean, bootstrapped to IPO.
Yeah.
And no one talks about it.
Well, I think, I mean, you know, let's not forget that that the tech press has to sell ads, and in order to sell ads, you need to write lots of stories, and in order to write lots of stories, you need to create, entertainment.
Something newsworthy.
You need to create something newsworthy.
Yeah.
And so these funding press releases that just sort of like every, I'm doing sound effects, so there was a snap. the funding announcements become standard white noise for the industry. And as a young entrepreneur, I mean, I got out of college and I was like, can't wait to raise money. You know, it wasn't even like, you know, I'm gonna like build a cool product. It was like, oh man, like, you know, like I'm sitting there like reading AVC.com every day and like learning about like all these guys that are getting people are giving them money to create things, and there's this weird culture where like you're not allowed to ask what their business model is. And
right.
we're going
to pretend like we're allergic to money.
Right.
And
it's
we're
like
gonna,
it's like, oh, I'm like too cool to think about a business model right now, because all I care about is product, which is actually like the worst possible thinking, because you know, when you say that, what you basically mean is like, I'm going to sell ads in a year and it's going to suck. But there's like, or it doesn't always suck to sell ads. but it's generally like, it's I think what we're talking about is like a cultural thing, it's a media thing, it's a and in some ways, it's sort of probably always.
Can I ask for the investors in the room? You know, there seem to be two polarizing ideas out there right now. One is you raise money so that your product can kind of find its product market fit. It can kind of find its legs, and what you think it is on day one is not necessarily what it'll be on day 100. And the reason you raise money is to give you that sort of breathing room to do that. Versus you should be creating businesses where day one there's some understanding of how they will have like a business model to them. And I've seen, you know, some product people go, I don't want to think about the business model because I'm going to worry about the product. And then other people say, no, you should be worried about the business model. It doesn't, you know, really matter the product. How do those two ideas kind of coexist, or do you have to philosophically pick one at the outset of your investment?
Are we talking about pure consumer internet?
Well, anyway, someone shows up to you, an entrepreneur shows up to you with some ideas. Are you encouraging them, like, don't worry about the business model now. Let's get you to some maturity, or I need you to start thinking about the business model.
My view is that, one, there actually aren't that many business models on the internet.
Right.
Yeah. Like, we can list all of them, right? You sell ads. It's transactional in nature. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe a couple, right? Like, there's actually not that many business models, first of all. And
pays for it.
Right. Somebody actually buys a thing that you're selling, right?
Yeah.
Commerce. So, like, there aren't that many. Is number one. And then number two, and hopefully there are more over time. And then number two is, I would just say, I don't know what Will thinks, but I would say there's no one way to think about building a company. And, you know, there's as an investor, I think you're kind of selling yourself short if you view everything in one single way.
Right.
Different founders are different, and different founders think about, you know, product first or business first. And there's no one way.
The other thing is that you made an interesting comment about raising money to have breathing room.
Right.
I would actually say it's the opposite. I think the rounds that you raise money to which to hunt for that product market fit are starting to go away.
Right.
I'm seeing more and more entrepreneurs show up having already reached product market fit because it is so cheap it's so cheap to build this stuff. You can launch it on Product Hunt and instantly figure out whether or not there's something there. And so I think that I would actually, in many cases, discourage entrepreneurs from raising capital to hunt for product market fit unless, let me refine that statement, raise venture capital
right.
to find product market
yeah,
fit.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there is room for, you know, angel,
like
early seed.
We were talking about this, like, what is, like,
stuff.
Pre-seed now? Like, seed has turned into, like, more Series A.
Right. It's like a gold card used to be the best credit
there's
card.
Yeah, right.
It's
there's
like,
difference.
It's like,
I mean, the fact, though, is that many companies, their first round of capital is in the millions of dollars.
Right.
And I think if you're raising millions of dollars in search for product market fit, that might not be the right amount
right.
of capital for
yeah.
for your company. I think there's probably much smaller amounts of capital that you might need.
Unless you're building a hardware startup in some cases where you need
hardware.
But I think to your other question was focus on product or focus on business model. If you're thinking, I would argue that if you're building a consumer app, that you can't do both at once. And if you focus, because in many cases, unless the customer is buying your product.
Mm-hmm.
The customer is kind of, the user is kind of, is the product itself,
right?
So they're kind of at odds with each other, where that combined with the need in many cases to achieve network effects kind of goes against focusing on monetizing. So you look at a lot of the Series A, B, and C growth investors always say you should try to get to scale first and then you'll figure out how to monetize.
Yes.
It sort of feels like a cop-out answer when you sort
right.
of sensationalize that into a headline in TechCrunch.
Right.
But in reality, there's something behind that in that you have to push on growth because whether because of defensibility or because you only really have something to sell once you achieve network effects. I think there are a whole number of reasons why you should focus on number one, product market fit, number two, scale first and foremost before trying to monetize something.
Yeah, but let's be, I mean, you didn't use the word, but what you're talking about is advertising. Like if you're
right.
If your product is not your business, meaning if you're not a Kickstarter where you're making money on,
right.
on
if
the
it's
transaction or you're not selling.
Right.
That
it's
only what I said
selling.
Applies only to
correct.
Consumer internet iPhone app.
Advertising business.
Advertising.
I mean, there's,
yeah.
we're talking about is media companies,
yes.
right? And so,
yeah.
and so you, and not only, I mean, so the your question is like, I don't advise you to think about business. The reality is like, no advertiser is going to give a shit about you. Can I
right.
say shit on this thing?
Yeah.
No
yeah.
advertiser is going to give a shit about you unless you're a
you
few million
yeah.
monthly uniques,
yeah.
right? And so it's but there's a big difference between I don't have time to think about the business model and focus on the product and. I know exactly what my business model is going to be.
Right.
It's advertising. I just am not large enough to start speaking with advertisers.
This has been like one of the more macro conversations, which is actually really fascinating because we also have people, founders and investors in this room. So it's been an interesting combo. But anyway, we should probably wrap it up because it's getting hot in here.
Yeah, it is
getting
hot.
I'm getting like
I thought that was just. I thought that was just
thick.
Maybe a combination of both. Do you guys want to mention anything? Plug anything?
Go buy an electric object.
Yeah.
What do you have?
I'm
gonna
pre-order mine.
$350,000 on Kickstarter.
We're $340,000.
After
stop pretending
two days?
Like you don't know it down to
yeah.
This is your checking his phone every 5 minutes in here.
The Kickstarter page refreshes automatically, but I insist on doing Control R just
nice.
To. Yeah, a couple days. It's going well.
Sweet.
So far.
Anything you want to mention, Will?
Electric objects.
Yeah. Come on, guys.
Yeah.
You're making me
I thank you to Ryan for having us.
Yeah,
yeah
thanks
great.
For
coming.
Yeah, this is my third podcast in a row, I think, since I've been here and doing one more tomorrow, and so
nice. I
fun.
Thought we were special, but
yeah, you're just one of many.
You're gonna cut this down. You're gonna cut this down to like a 30-second soundbite of Nick talking about venture capital.
No, we'll just do like 2x. We'll just be all chipmunks
is
here.
Is there a way we can cut this down just to one funding announcement of some sort?
Yeah,
that's what people want to hear.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, thanks, guys.
Awesome, thank you.
Yeah.